Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming. We start these lectures with the title Mathematical Theory of Plasticity. It is planned that it will be 8 lectures. And before going to the subject, I would like to make a short introduction and explain what will be in this course. Actually, you see, the subject Mathematical Theory of Plasticity is a very wide subject, and in 8 lectures it is not possible to give a complete overview of this topic. So forcibly it is necessary to select something. And the choice which I made is like this. There will be the first part, which will be basically devoted to fundamental facts in continuum mechanics, because plasticity theory is a part of continuum mechanics, and it is not possible to discuss these models without giving overview of the fundamental principles of continuum mechanics. And then we restrict ourselves to those facts which are mostly related to the theory of solids. After that, we proceed to elastoplastic media. And part two, which in this diagram lies inside this circle, is this one. This is particularly related to elastoplastic models and their investigation. And we will discuss basically three things. First of all, I will give you overview of description of some most frequently used models in the elastoplasticity. They are like Henke plasticity or Kolomor plasticity or plasticity with hardening, models of plastic fluids, like Bingham fluid. There are two basic things which are necessary to discuss in this context. The first thing is qualitative analysis, the things like existence, regularity, etc. Actually, problems related to existence, they will be discussed, especially in the context of Henke plasticity model, because this is a part of a very interesting class of mathematical models related to the so-called linear growth functionals. And there is a large specificity of these models being compared with other models. For example, problems with quadratic or power growth functionals, this is completely different story. So this will be discussed, and not only for Henke, also for Kolomor plasticity. But regularity problems, these are special problems, which are rather technical, rather complicated. I will only mention some results and will not go deeply into this. Instead, we will more detailedly discuss quantitative analysis of these problems, things like convergence, numerical algorithms, how to create sequence of approximations, and what is the one of the main points is how to get reliable error control, how to verify quality of this approximate solution. So this is the second part. Also, I will try to give you some literature. So for those who are interested in investigation of certain parts of this very, very big problematic, they will find some references. So we are now preparing to study one of the most interesting models in continuum mechanics. If you look in general to mechanics of continuum media, there are three basic parts of it. This is gas dynamics, fluids, and solids. So now we will go here. And theory of solids itself, it has certain amount of very interesting applications. And first of all, it is, of course, elasticity from this theory. In a considerable part, modern analysis have been created, have been generated. Plasticity theory, composites, plates and shells models, theory of large deformations, and of course the most challenging and unsolved phenomenon in the theory of solids, this is the problem of fracture, which is still not solved, and plasticity theory, especially perfect plasticity, gives some knowledge, some ideas about how might this problem be solved. About physical grounds of plasticity. Models of elasticity and plasticity reflect two different types of behavior of a media. One is reversible and another one is irreversible. And I would like to start with giving you these names, that the mechanical foundations of plasticity theory were basically developed in the 19th century and in the first part of the 20th century. And there are several names. Maybe you find some familiar names here. But mathematical problems related to correctness of this boundary value and initial boundary value problems were studied much later. And basically this was the problematic which actively investigated in the 70s and 80s years. There was a big blow around this topic at that time. And here you see several names of people contributed. We will refer to these names later when discuss existence problems. From the mechanical, physical point of view, what is the difference between elasticity and plasticity? If you have elastic structure, of course, this is only a simple diagram, but just to give you an idea what is behind all this. If you have elastic deformation, then you have this structure and you see atoms or molecules which are joined with each other by some links. Then you put force, and then the whole structure is shifted like this. But links remain the same. So this particle is linked with this one. And when you remove this load, then the original structure remains the same. So this is the elastic behavior. And if you have plastic behavior, then everything is different. So this is original configuration. Then you put this load, and you see that the load is that big, or the construction is that weak, that at a certain moment, now this particle B1 is not anymore the closest to this one. This internal links has been changed. And when you put away this load, then you have new configuration where B1 is connected with A2 and B2 is connected with A3. This means that one layer shifted one step to a certain direction. And this is known as the dislocation zone. This is one of the mechanisms of plasticity. If you look at it in metal, then you can see these lines which arises due to collection of these dislocation zones. And it is a well-known phenomenon that in metals these deformations are localized in these strip-like zones. So on the micro level they are easily identified. But plastic deformations are easily identified on a macro level also. So then you have changes which cannot disappear by themselves. You have to do something. Actually, there are many other mechanisms, because internal structure of a media may be quite different. There may be porous media which contains a lot of voids, and then these effects develop in one way. Then there is media like sand, or media with internal cellular structure. And in all these cases, you have different models of plasticity, different laws. Now we proceed to the background, and I apologize for those who very well know tensor analysis, but I need to have some introduction and to identify notation for those who are not that good in this area, because otherwise it will be not possible to understand further material. So just a quick reminder, vectors and tensors. We operate in a basic physical space, which we always call RD, or if we consider time-dependent problems, then we have this space-time cylinder, the standard thing, and we denote vectors like this, introduce their scalar product, and in all parts we will use this repeated index agreement. So if in a formula some index is repeated, then means that actually there is a sum like this. So this is equivalent to this. This is a standard notation. Also, I would like to say right from the beginning that I will not use curvilinear coordinate systems. I will use only orthogonal systems in which we may not distinguish between covariant and contravariant components. So I will not write upper and lower indices, as you can see in many cases, because in this rather simple, simplified course, this is not indeed required. What is tensor? Tensor is one of the main elements of continuum mechanics. We can look at it as a tensor is an operator which maps vectors to vectors. This is the simplest definition which you can give. If you are not going into differentiation analysis, then tensor can be identified with matrix, tensor of the second range. And this is what is written here. So tau is this tensor which maps A to B, and due to the summation principle, summation agreement, it can be written like this. Like this or like this, we define units in the space of tensors. And symmetric tensors belong to this set. This letter S means that we are talking about symmetric tensors. In this tensor space, we can introduce the product, which will be denoted by two dots, and again here this repeated summation in principle is used. We have this one. It is quite obvious that then we can introduce these moduluses or norms as you wish. Important role in the analysis of tensors plays a special tensor of a special kind, which is called diad. Diad is this object. This is the special symbol which is used to denote diadic product of two vectors, and this is such a matrix which is made of the components of two vectors. If we introduce the unit vectors of the system, which is defined here, that this is unit vector, and this means that our system is orthogonal, then any tensor can be represented in the following form. This is a scalar component, which is the value of tau and the line I and rho j multiplied by this dyadic tensor, which has non-zero component only in one place of this matrix, namely in the line I and rho j. This is a very convenient representation of tensors. And it is not difficult to see that if we have some vector v, then multiplication by dyadic tensor gives this one, which is equivalent to that we rewrite it in this form, because yj is simply this one. And if we substitute instead of v here, if we substitute another basic unit vector, then we have this formula, which is easy to remember, because it says you that if you have this dyad multiplying by another vector, then it is simply this vector, and instead of this one, you have the Kronecker symbol. This is very convenient. Using this formula, we can play with tensors, make different multiplications, algebraic manipulations, easily. For example, if we want to multiply tensor by B, then we do it like this. I rewrite this tau in this form, and I rewrite this B in this form, and then I put B aside, apply this rule. So instead of G and S, I have Kronecker symbol, which means that G equals S, and I have this. Then important role in the continuum media, especially in the constitutive relations for continuum media, plays the so-called tensors of the fourth range. Who are they? Tensors of the fourth range, they are linear operators which maps tensors of the second range to tensors of the second range. So it is the second generation. And quite similar to the previous one, we can write like this, that this T, which is object from here, acts on this sigma and produces another tensor of the second range, which is formally, using again this index representation, can be written like this. Quite similarly to the previous case, we can introduce, we cannot call them dyads, but there are some objects of the fourth range which are similar to dyads, and say that any tensor of the fourth range can be uniquely represented in such a form. And then we can have similar rules and this and that, and develop algebraic relations, algebraic rules in a unified manner. It is necessary to discuss some more points, because they will be in the lecture course used several times later. What is the multiplication of tensors? Multiplication of tensors is the tensor which we denote like sigma tau, which is defined by the rule. For any vector, we first apply tensor tau to it and get a vector. And then we apply to this vector this guy and get another vector. Then this is the formal definition. If you write it and apply to a unit vector formally, you have this obvious form from where you see how the components of this multiplication look like. So you have this rule. Also, it is necessary to say about invariants. Every tensor has certain parts which do not depend on the coordinate system. Whatever coordinate system you take, components of a tensor, they change. But there are some parts which do not. And these are three standard notation for three invariants of a tensor tau. They are called first, second, and third invariant. Or alternatively, these invariants, they can be defined as using this determinant of generated by this tau. So coefficients of this determinant can be assigned as a as other invariants of a tensor. I think most of you know this, but let's fix everything. Now we must talk about orthogonal decomposition of a tensor, because this again will be used in constitutive relations of plasticity. For every tensor, we can define its deviator. By the definition, deviator, it will be always denoted by this letter D, by superscript D, is tau minus 1 divided by dimensionality multiplied by trace and unit tensor. It is easy to see that these parts, this tau deviator and this, which is often called spherical part, they are orthogonal. Indeed, if I multiply this guy, if I multiply it by this one, then formally I replace this tau d by this complex, and when I multiply tau by this guy, I have this, because unit tensor converted with tau gives me trace. And the second part is direct. You have this one, and here you have product of unit by unit, which gives you d. And this d is reduced with this power 2, and you have 0. And from here you see that these two components are indeed orthogonal. And therefore, we can always decompose tensor like this. And here, just note, I would like to note that for the case d equals 2, this deviatoric has a transparent and simple form. Now, another preliminary part. I want to remind you some basic things in continuum mechanics. And what are they? They are principles on which basic equations are constructed. These equations are conservation of mass and dynamics. And then, when we understand this, we can proceed to principles on which constitutive relations are constructed. So if we are talking about basic relations in continuum mechanics, first of all, we must recall two ways of describing continuum media. And they are related to names of Lagrange and Euler. There are two ways of describing movement evolution of continuum media. The first one is due to Lagrange, and which is known as particle method. In the method of Lagrange, every element of a media, every particle, is marked at the initial point of time. You can make some color spot on it. And then all the evolution is controlled, how this particle is moving. So here, this A is the reference to this particle, and T is time. So if we give this law, then you have a Lagrange description. Actually, it can be presented like this. You have this body at time T0. So in standard definition, it is called initial configuration of a body. And then after some time, you have this one, and this is called actual configuration of a body. So if you have a particle which here was marked A, that then after a certain time it will be here, and this will be this x of A and t. And then the displacement which will happen is this one. This is the Lagrange principle. What are main objects in continuum mechanics and also in plasticity, of course? These main objects are displacement, first of all. This is a vector-valued function, which we just saw on a picture. And in Lagrange description, it is said to be the difference between position of a particle at moment t and its initial position. If I differentiate this thing with respect to t, then I have velocity. If I twice differentiate, then I have acceleration, which is necessary to take into account if I want to consider dynamic systems. If I consider stationary or quasi-stationary systems, this never appears in my equations. But if I consider dynamics, this will. Then other important parts, they are density and temperature. These are scalar-valued functions, which also depend on x and t, and we will denote them like this. Also, there are other things which I do not mention on this transparency, but they are entropy and energy. But in our further analysis, they will not be used in our simple models. Therefore, I omit. Then we always have volume and surface loads, which are vector-valued functions, and the components of stress-strain situation inside the body, they are strains and stresses. So they are main objects, main inhabitants of this theory, if you wish. What are relations between them? And when we will discuss these relations, it is worth mentioning some basic facts, which sometimes are not explicitly discussed, but they are on the background of this theory. These assumptions, which sometimes may be not true. So one of these assumptions is like this, that classical theory of continuum media is based on the assumption that this law is continuously differentiable for any time t, and that this determinant of actual coordinate with respect to the initial coordinate is non-zero. We know that at the initial moment of time, this quantity is 1, because at the initial moment of time, this x is A. So it means that if this is continually differentiable, and this is at a certain moment, at the moment t0 is 1, this means that there exists at least some neighborhood of this t0 where this relation is invertible. And we can, in principle, resolve it back and have this law. A is A of x and t. And now we come to another description of a movement in continuum media, which is called Euler description. Euler description is like this. You do not control particle, but you control space and time position. So you would like to know what will be the velocity or other quantities which describe continuum media at any particular point of space and any particular moment of time. So it is like a space-time frame, rigid, and you look at the media in such a way. So it is possible to recalculate only on the basis of the assumption which I made, I would like to outline. But in principle, it is possible to recalculate Lagrange coordinates to Euler coordinates and back. For example, assume that we know a function, some function, temperature, for example, defined in terms of Lagrange coordinates. How to find its value at a certain point x star and time t starts? It's straightforward in this way. You just substitute and you have it. But vice versa is not that simple. Assume now that you have Euler description, how you can recalculate to Lagrange description. Assume that we have a particle which at the moment xt have this velocity. What we know? We know that next position of this particle at the time t plus infinitely small period dt will be this one, x plus dx. It will be this original position plus velocity multiplied by dt, from where we have this one. What is this? This is actually, if we look at it, we can look at it as a system of ordinary differential equations with respect to x, which has a solution with some unknown constants. And these unknown constants, in principle, must be defined throughout these initial relations. So this C will depend on A. And then we can reconstruct the Lagrange description from this one. Of course, all these words are, how to say, rather formal, because if you would like to do this in real life situation, it might be not that simple. But for mechanicians, it is mostly enough. They say that in principle, it is enough. Another topic I would like to shortly discuss, these are local and convective derivatives, which are closely related to Lagrange description and to Euler description. If we have Lagrange coordinates, then derivative of a quantity with respect to time is easy to compute. It is a straightforward matter because this A does not depend on t. So it's just a partial derivative, nothing else. But if you, as typically, for example, in fluid mechanics, if you operate in Euler coordinate system, then it is not that simple because you have this relation and your x also depends on t. So if you differentiate, you have this derivative, partial derivative, and then you have this complex, which is called convectional derivative. And this convectional derivative is the origin of difficulties in Navier-Stokes equation. This is where from the convective term comes. And there where from this enormous mathematical difficulty arises. There they come from this representation. Next point, theory of strains. We have a body. This is a part of this body in our original initial configuration, and this is a part of it in the actual configuration. So here we have an elementary beam, if you wish, or something very small, which is transformed to this one. This is dA and this is dx, and these are the components. So what is strain? Strain, in general, is this difference. Of course, there are other components of strain which reflect angles, but I'm not talking about them. Let's talk about the simplest thing. And our aim is to see where from these strain, special forms of strain tensors come from. I can write this dx, obviously, in this form. Again, there is summation of the repeated index. And then the modulus, squared modulus of this dx will be this one, and I can write it in this form. This is I and this is J. And analogously, this guy has this representation, and here I have this S. So if I subtract this from this, then I have, you see, this complex. There will be something here, and here there will be products of elementary vectors, di and dj, which says me that if I do this and consider two elementary elements of a body, then the guy which controls this difference will be tensor, some tensor. Moreover, we can explicitly calculate its components using this formula and this formula, and you have this one. So this is the guy which will stand here. And this guy is known as the Green's tensor of strain, of large strain. If I take the representation of displacement, and I prefer to express this tensor not through x, not through the component in the actual configuration, but throughout displacement, then I use this algebraic formula, and I see that dxm by dij will be dum plus delta, Kronecker symbol. So if I write this component, it will be this multiplied by this. So there will be this cross term, which is here. Then there will be this multiplied by this, but then I must take into account that m equals g, and therefore I have this guy. And then vice versa, I have this multiplied by this, I have this one. And when I multiply this by this, I have this. And then this delta goes away. So as a result, I have this one. This is the form of Green's tensor of large strains, which is, if you go into the theory of large deformations, like mechanical theory which describes, for example, behavior of rubber, then you will operate with this tensor, which is nonlinear. Quite analogously, I will not go to this deeply, you can construct another representation of strain now in the actual coordinate system, the difference only with respect to which system it will be. And this tensor in mechanics is called Almanzi tensor. It has this form, and if you express it in terms of displacements, it will be this. In the theory which we mostly be interested, these quantities are small. And if they are small, we can put away their product, because the product of these quantities will be much smaller than any of them. And then we arrive to these simplified forms of Green and Almanzi tensor, like this. And then we are in the situation of the theory of small strains, where this strain is called the Cauchy strain. This is the Cauchy strain tensor. Probably this is formula which mathematicians know very well and operate frequently, but this is only a very simplified version of what is in reality. In the theory of small strains, we may not distinguish between actual configuration and initial. We can look at the problem like this. We have some domain which is changed insignificantly. We do not consider these effects caused by small changes of this domain. And everything acts in one domain. This is a typical picture, for example, in linear elasticity, where initial coordinate system, that one is A, and the actual in reality are not distinguished. And we operate in one, and we have this strain tensor. Then talking about strains, it is necessary to mention this space of rigid motions, which is an important space and which is defined as the space of vectors which annihilate strain. If you wish, we can say that rigid motion space is the kernel of the operator of small deformations. And since we have such type representation of the gradient, so here we have the gradient tensor. So this is a matrix which contains all partial derivatives of all components of vector W. And this one can be decomposed into this sum. This is a symmetric part, which is exactly our Cauchy tensor. And this is a skew symmetric part, which has this form. Here I wrote it. So skew symmetric means that if I transpose, the sign minus arises. How to represent the space of rigid motions analytically? Assume that we have such a vector W that this is zero. What is the implication of this fact? Let's take this Q-symmetric tensor and differentiate with respect to some coordinate xk. This derivative we also will write using comma to apply more compact notation. So here and later on, comma with the index means partial derivative with respect to some coordinate. So if I continue, I can write this as follows. You see, this term is exactly the same as this one, but with the opposite sign. So actually, derivative of this is this plus this. But here, I added and subtracted the same quantity. And why it was done? It was done to reduce everything to this form. Because what is here is this epsilon component of the strain tensor divided by J. You see, this J is here and here. And quite similarly here, we have this component differentiated by I. You see, I is here and here. But since this guy is zero, this is zero and this is zero, so this is zero. This is a well-known relation for skew-symmetric tensor, that this skew-symmetric tensor, its derivative on if W belongs to the space of rigid motions is zero. What it means? It means that this is some fixed tensor. It does not depend on coordinate. So we can write it as omega zero. So we see that in this case, our vector W has this form. It is some given vector, which does not depend on x, plus omega zero multiplied by x. And this is the form of the space of rigid motion. So every rigid motion can be represented like some fixed vector, which gives you deflection along certain coordinate x. In 3D, there will be three. Plus three rigid rotations. Again, in 3D, there will be three, like this, and like this. And these rotations are related to this omega 0. Dimension of this plane, of this space, is this one. One other thing I would like to mention is the well-known Cesaro formula, which is widely used in analytics related to continuum media. And the origin of this formula, probably Cesaro, when he derived this formula, he started from this relation. This is a well-known formula in analysis showing that how you can compute the value at some point x having the derivative of this function. It is easy to see that we can extend this relation to vector-valued functions, in particular like this. So if we know this gradient, and we know the initial point, then we can compute value at a certain point x1. So the question is whether or not we can have similar formula, but where instead of full gradient here will be only symmetric part of this gradient, only epsilon. The answer is positive, and it is given by Cesaro's formula. And I will continue deriving it in 10 minutes. We have a break.